kill 100,000 kids. You can make up stories about how that's not what you did. You can bomb dams in Korea. You can party as they drown. You can bomb Cambodia, burn the forests and the towns. You can bomb Panama City. You can bomb Sudan. You can bomb Damascus. You can bomb Afghanistan. You can bomb Benghazi. Pretend you've come to liberate. You can bomb Belgrade. You can bomb Islamic State. Maybe we'll learn. Once all the bombing ceased, you can't bomb peace.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, the second Trump presidency has not disappointed those believing he'd be the end of America, ushering in the last days of the superpower's democratic pretensions. As of writing, ice brown shirts are running roughshod over citizens and non-citizen alike, even as red state National Guard units patrol resistance in liberal cities like Chicago, Portland, Los Angeles, and New York. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest level, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, the Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World, and his latest is the newly released The Navalny Novichok Complex, Chronicle of a Staging. John's recent article at Dances with Bears, Fuhrer Fascism, How Did Vsevolod Know That Trump's Meeting with the Generals Was a Loyalty Test? Because Russians remember Hitler's Führerride of 1935, provides history's first draft of the last days of American democracy. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure. Maybe you could help me with the pronunciation of Vsevolod or whatever. Yeah. And tell us what that means.
I don't know how to do it slowly. Vsevolod. 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 Vsevolod.
Easy for you to say. Well, John, now, with all your Russia bona fides, as I just laid out, firstly, I want to, lest anybody accuse you of not having a dog in the American democracy fight, remind that you actually are an American citizen. You've worked within the American political system right at the top for a president, no less. And John, I guess my question to you is, well, did you ever see anything like the likes of what we're seeing right now?
Short answer, no, not at all. And I'm hardly the only one who's never seen this before. Mm. Just to be quick about it, I was a member of the President's Reorganization Force. I've forgotten its last name. President's Reorganization Project, PRP, that came out of the Jimmy Carter campaign of 1976. Carter said, and was running on a slogan, end the imperial presidency. That was the presidency that Gerald Ford had inherited when Richard Nixon stepped down. I was had been working in and on the British head of government and the Australian head of government. I'd been in the head of government's staff in Australia, and I was an expert, you might say, on how the head of government runs the policy-making system of the head of government. So when Carter won the election of 1976 and assembled a transition force and then began to implement the campaign promises, the President's Reorganization Project was set up. This was a staff of about 20 people. I was one of them, initially in the White House, and then moved across the street to the Office of Management and Budget. And our job was to help the president reorganize the entire federal government, but we started with the White House itself. And uniquely at that time, I proposed to Carter that we analyze 10 decisions that he had already made in the first 4 to 6 months and analyzed exactly how he'd come to the decision point and how the decision point was influenced or affected by the organization which fed the information and ultimately the decision-making memorandum. I can go on talking quite a lot about it, but we'll skip that. What I can say, to be short, is it ended, our role ended with a cabinet room briefing of Carter, was having to flip through a 300-page report that we had compiled. And one of the parts of that report that I had been directly involved in analyzed the way in which the agencies inside the executive office, for example, the National Security Council, then run by Zbigniew Brzezinski, were distorting and influencing the choices the president had. Brzezinski intervened the night before we were to brief Carter and said, if that's not pulled out, and he will attack me and several others, including the head of the PRP, the President's Reorganization Project, and kill the Air Force officer's career of a man called Leonard Verner Monty, who had been working with me on this project. So we were told to shut our mouths or lose our jobs. And so that's the way it went with Carter. Brzezinski prevailed. Brzezinski dominated the foreign policy-making process of Carter, of Carter's, and he mesmerized Carter. He also controlled Carter. And what they decided to do, among many things, was the run-up to the Afghanistan war. And they did it in secret. Why am I saying this? Because the fundamentals have changed radically with Trump, with President Donald Trump. Carter could read. Carter was capable of going through a 300-page document showing how his decision-making process had been distorted by the very staff he had hired to advise him. Advice was being manipulated, and Carter could see it. The fact was that the staff intervened to prevent Carter hearing that from us. And the section of that report that told Carter that, and the evidence we had of two particular decisions we examined for him to show him what Brzezinski was doing, they were all removed. So the staff prevailed over the president, didn't it? Now, that's many years ago. That's 1977. That's 48 years ago. What do we have now? Donald Trump doesn't read. He can't talk with a vocabulary more complex than a 10 or 11-year-old, depending on what school you send your American children to. He likes pictures. Unlike most presidents, even Ronald Reagan, Trump has only one intelligence briefing a week. The others had it every day. The intelligence briefing for Trump comes usually with immediately before lunch with Vice President J.D. Vance. What we have with Trump is, in fact, a person who looks to be making decisions but doesn't. Trump is not a decision maker. He is a decision reinforcer, promoter, publicizer. And the system that's been built around him, principally by Stephen Miller, the deputy chief of staff in the White House. Miller has been with Trump since the first campaign. Miller began with controlling the tweet machine. Currently, Miller oversees domestic policy and the tweet machine. What happens is that Trump is basically forced, compelled, told what the decisions will be in terms he will approve. His approval is then registered under Miller's direction in several different ways. First, the tweets, the endless stream of tweets through which Trump appears to be talking and appears to be thinking and appears to be deciding, whether it's 100% tariff punishment for China, 50% tariff punishment for India, sanctions on Russia, calling the President Putin a paper tiger, proposing to escalate the war in the Ukraine by supplying Tomahawk long-range missiles to the Ukrainians through NATO. Whether those big decisions are actually made by Trump is no longer in doubt. Trump doesn't make them. He confirms after by tweet or by these five-minute, what are known in the White House as press gaggles. That's when Trump appears in front of the press on an airplane or appears in front of the press before his airplane, helicopter, takes off. And he uses scripted slogans, jingles, and one-liners, which he endlessly repeats. That's the scope of his memory. So you have an individual who can't and doesn't read, a man who prefers pictures in his briefings, a man who gets very little intelligence briefing, and whose memory capacity is limited to jingles, slogans, and one-liners he repeats over and over again, and you can see it. And the interesting thing about this unprecedented situation is, first of all, what I'm telling you isn't widely discussed, but it's very well known. And second, on the foreign level, all the foreign leaders, Macron of France, Starmer of England, and Carney of Canada, each of them, having met Trump, understands how this system works. Maybe they understand it less well because they aren't as well informed about the way the White House works, although they've got intelligence services, ambassadors, embassies, and experts to help them. They understand that the way to get Trump to decide for them, for their benefit, either on tariff policy or trade policy or foreign policy, keeping the Ukraine war going, they understand you do two things. And this is indeed what President Putin is doing, like Prime Minister Carney. One, you treat Trump with great respect. You never discuss what I'm saying now. You flatter him. You describe him as a genius, as a father, as Mark Rutte, the former Dutch Prime Minister, now NATO Secretary General, has called him. That you flatter him, you ingratiate with him, you touch him, you make him your candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize, and so on. You've seen it all already, and we're only in October, the 10th month of his second term. This is the man's mentality. It's uniquely simple. It's uniquely cognitively handicapped. But it's also uniquely open to manipulation. And that's what's happening.
Well, in your article, again, the Führer fascism, how did that word I can't pronounce know that Trump's meeting with the generals was a loyalty test because Russians remember Hitler's Führerride of 1935? Features, speaking of pictures, an extraordinary photograph of the collected military heads. And it is under the Countering Domestic Terrorism and Organized Political Violence paper issued by the White House that appears with your article. Could you describe, John, first of all, what the Führerride of 1935 means for those younger in our audience or who don't study the ancient history of the 20th century? And what was going on in this picture? Because it really is an extraordinary picture and an extraordinary document.
Everything you say is right, Chris. I just want to say, because we have a Canadian audience, that the fundamental way in which Canadians interpret Trump's threats to Canada and the political assessment Canadians must make of Prime Minister Carney's performance so far depend on the things we are talking about. Carney, so I don't want us to wander too far away, we don't have much time, from Carney's calculation that he must appease, indeed to some extent grovel in front of Trump in order to obtain the Canadian constituencies he represents, and there's a question of who in fact Carney is representing these days when he speaks and agrees and negotiates with the Americans. But let's come back. What I'm trying to say is that Carney's performance reflects an understanding of ingratiating Trump will be in Canada's best interest. That's debatable. And the more Canadian voters look at the way the Trump system is working, as we're discussing, the less confident they will be in Prime Minister Carney's defense of Canadian sovereignty. That's the bottom line for Canada. That's the bottom political line for judging whether Carney will honor his promise to defend Canadian sovereignty or sell out as part of a clever strategy of ingratiating Trump. To go back then, what happened in Germany as the Nazi Party grew powerful and employed the brown shirts on the street as gangs was to develop a doctrine of domestic enemies. And this was very well symbolized by a martyr. Horst Wessel was a street thug, a former German army soldier in World War I, who failed to pay his rent. And when his landlady brought a couple of tough guys around to enforce, it turned out that the tough guys were also members of the Communist Party. In the scuffle, Wessel was shot and he subsequently died. But he left behind a song, a hymn of fighting against essentially the Reds, the left, the radical left. Sound familiar? Yeah, it should. Stephen Miller has put this entire doctrine of fighting the radical left, it's not called red anymore, in domestic terms, so that what's happening is, on the one hand, military occupation of democratic voter cities. And we've seen that started with Los Angeles, then Washington, D.C., Memphis, Tennessee, Portland, Oregon, Chicago's next, and so on. This is a militarization of these voter bases. Second, the creation of a brand new and very large and very well-funded and very powerful new police force, ICE. The combination is not, in fact, influencing American voters to approve Trump's performance, but that's not what Trump believes, right? As this system of repression to preserve their power and preserve the money that their power earns for themselves, for their families, their friends, and their constituents and political donors, as this process intensifies, what happens is there's resistance inside the Pentagon and inside the military services. There's resistance. Why? Why not? Since May, Secretary Hegseth and Deputy Secretary of Defense Feinberg have instituted a purge. In the name of Lena Mina, they've started a 20% cut of the 4-star and 3-star generals, to be followed by a 10% cut of all flag officers and National Guard commands. In other words, since May, and it's relatively underreported, there's a purge of disloyal or suspected military officers who are suspected of being opposed to the use of the United States military in domestic political conflicts, like the cities. That's covered by the cover story, the camouflage, that Trump is fighting domestic terrorism, or the Reds, or the radical left, as the Horst Wessel song once proclaimed. That song became the Nazi Party anthem. And by 1935, Hitler was increasingly concerned at the potential disloyalty and resistance of the German officer corps. So instead of a standard oath of loyalty to the Reich, to the German state, and to the German constitution, Hitler introduced a loyalty oath to himself, to the Führer. So Führerride is, as I understand it, Führer oath, an oath of loyalty to the person and the political power of the Führer, of an individual. That's Miller's idea. And gradually, it's becoming clear to everyone who watches that that Miller's way of speaking, the way he spoke at the Kirk Memorial, Kirk being Charlie Kirk being the equivalent of Horst Wessel for the Trump Organization, a martyr who's been attacked and killed by the radical left. Tucker Carlson said it. Miller said it. And as the private eye in London recently said, the way he talks, Stephen Miller, his probably sound, I'm quoting from the private eye in London, probably sounded better in the original German. Now, that's a clever, cute way of likening the Miller-Trump operation as it's developing, including the loyalty assembly at Quantico Base that you referred to the Hitler military loyalty oath and the civilian loyalty oath that was introduced to the Führer in 1935, which in turn was introduced to the accompaniment of the Horst Wessel song. So what we've got here is, in many respects, very similar to the way in which the propagandists of the Nazi Party, Goebbels in particular, developed the idea of loyalty to the Führer facing domestic threats and external threats. And you can see that being played out on the foreign map with stunts like the destruction of speedboats off the coast of Venezuela, 1,000 nautical miles south of mainland U.S. coast, accused of being drug runners, bringing lethal drugs to the United States, tweeted in a composition Miller did for Trump, with the accompaniment, this boat would have destroyed 20,000 American lives. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do I need to say more?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio, and I'm speaking with John Helmer, a journalist and author. He's spent decades in living in and reporting from Russia, and he's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. And we're talking about his article that I can barely pronounce right now, dealing with this takeover in the United States. When we look at it, John, from up here in Canada, it looks absolutely insane. The soldiers in the streets and these thugs, these ICE thugs, that the composition of which seems to include the Wild Boys or the... Now, I'm gapping on the name of these guys, but clearly a fascistic order. In your article, though, John, you finished by saying, and about the generals that received this message to a thinly veiled loyalty oath along the lines of Hitler's Führerride, you say, quote, the generals at Quantico did not give their response to Trump. They listened in silence and left in silence. Apparently, they will respond with deeds when Trump begins to fulfill his promises and sends troops to democratic cities. Well, we see that's already happening. What, John, are the rumblings within the military? Do you know how this is all being accepted or commented upon or what?
I don't know. I'm a Russia correspondent. Right, we should talk a bit more about that.
But you are an American, though, right? Yeah,
and as we began, I was in the White House and then at the Office of Management and Budget for the Carter administration, all 4 brief years of it. And that's the basis of the expertise and the evidence for answering your first and important question, Chris. Has this ever happened before? And the answer is no, it has not. It's not like, superficially, it sounds like the Red Scare of the Joseph McCarthy, Senator Joseph McCarthy period, but it's much deeper. It runs much deeper than that. And Americans, I need to point out, are not fooled. In other words, the coalition of young voters, black voters, Hispanic voters, and whites in the battleground states that put Trump back into power is breaking up. And the more desperately the White House understands this to be happening, the more dissent, resistance, leaks to the media are bound to happen. That's why Trump attacks the media, expels various reporters from his presence. This past week, the head of the Taliban met with the press in India but refused to allow women to attend the press conference in an extraordinary insult to Indian women, which is causing a major Indian backlash against the Taliban in India today. Is there a backlash against Trump's exclusion of various reporters he doesn't like? Or yes, there is in the United States. But let's come to the reason for the desperation measures, which affect the military, and then, in fact, everyone. You used the word fascist, Chris. That's increasingly becoming an offense, a criminal offense. In the U.S. The State Department has recently revoked the visas of foreign students or foreigners on visas in the United States for making social media posts which have accused Charlie Kirk, for example, of a program that was fascistic. Somebody, as I read in the papers today, lost their right to live in the United States because they said that. So the level of repression is rising very sharply inside the military and outside the military. Trump began his speech at Quantico to those 800 plus military officers by saying, if you don't like it, you may leave the room. Now, he repeated that line. You'll find his exact words in the piece you mentioned on Dances with Bears, Chris. He repeated that line at the end of the speech. It's a warning. If you want to resist my orders domestically or against Venezuela or against Russia or against China or against Iran, against the people of Gaza, if you resist, if you leak to the papers and we catch you, we will fire you. You will not only lose your rank, you will lose your pension. The threats to the 800 are very considerable. So it's not at all surprising. There's no leaks. There are no leaks yet. But, and it's a huge but, and again, I come back to the calculation that the office of Prime Minister Carney is misjudging. American voters have not been persuaded by Trump's positives. In the month, over this past month, the 4 weeks since he announced bringing peace after 3,000 years to Gaza and Palestine and the Middle East, Trump's disapproval didn't shift. In other words, there was no liftoff of approval for his, quotes, peacemaking in Gaza. American voters weren't paying attention to that.
Well, now, John, I hate to jump in, but we've got just a couple seconds left here on my recording. I want to remind people to go to John's site, johnhelmer.net, to read more of John's work and to find out more about this story in particular. And thank Chris Gilbert for coming on, bringing us up to speed with what's going on in Venezuela. That's all I've got for this week. Until the next time.
You can make up all the rules. You can bomb the ancient cities of Yemen and Iran. You can bomb